Hello, Freedom Nation. It's Jeff here once again with another episode of the Freedom Nation podcast. And we're out of the studio today in my office, so you can see the disaster behind me. We are not AI. We are real. So take some time. Watch the show. Today I've got on Dr. Axel Meyerhofer. I actually was interviewed on his podcast, and we got along so well, we decided to return the podcast this way, and I'm interviewing him today. So he is a real estate investor, a freedom junkie like you and I, and in addition to that, he's got some great ideas on technology. So stay tuned. We'll be right back on in just one second.
Welcome to the Freedom Nation Podcast with Jeff Kickle. On this show, Jeff shares his expertise in financial and retirement planning from a different perspective. Planning for your Freedom Day, which is the first day that you wake up and have enough income or assets and do not have to go to work that day. Learn how to calculate what you need, how to generate income sources, and listen to interviews from others who've done it themselves. Get ready to experience your own Freedom Day.
Hey everybody, welcome to the show. Axel, how are you, my friend?
I'm very good, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
Great having you on the show. I had a blast on yours. So let's get started. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your story? How did you get to where you're at today?
Yeah, basically, I'm originally from Germany. I wanted to fly for the airlines, but I got out of school at the wrong time and then joined the military. Started to learn how to fly for the German Air Force, and then was introduced to a program where you can basically do somebody else's job. So I basically took the job of the director of operations of a U.S. Air Force fighter wing, and that guy took my job. I was at the time the deputy director of the flight school for Germany, and so he had to learn how to fly the jets I was flying, and I learned how to fly the F-111, and I did that. And then out of that came a bunch of different things, because the whole thing was supposed to be just 3 years or so. And then I got another assignment on another U.S. Air Force base, and here we were pretty quickly at the end of my military career, and companies recruited me. I think I had maybe a week off after retiring from the Air Force and then starting my next job in a software company. I tried that for a while and came to the conclusion being an employee is really not my thing. So then in 2005, I started my own company, did that for a while. It took off pretty well initially as a consulting company. And then I realized, hold it for a moment. At the software company, we had a 401k. At the military, they had basically like a pension system. I'm not that old. What am I going to do, you know, as a business owner? I have to do something, you know, I don't want to work forever. And I looked into it. And if you think about 2005, was not that far away from the dot-com bust. So I'm like, no, I don't want to go into stocks. I don't think that's my thing. So I started researching and basically looked at what do people successful in business do with their money if they make any profits. And a lot of them, I wouldn't want to say all, but a lot of them invest in real estate. And at the time, because that software company that had recruited us, that got me to Santa Barbara, California, you know, probably one of the most expensive places, at least at the time in the whole country, I'm like, okay, let me see if I can invest in real estate. And like within 2.5 seconds, I found out, nope, not possible here. And so I thought, okay, well, there must be a way. And I started looking around and I discovered two things, that there is a concept called turnkey investing. And there was a guy, because I heard about the concept first, and then, you know, even though it wasn't that common at the time yet, I went on Amazon or I think Barnes & Noble, some of these bookstores, and went in and said, any books about turnkey investing? And there was a guy named Chris Kozier who literally wrote a book called Turnkey Revolution, describing the story of the family that started Memphis Invest. And that company still around is called REI Nation today. And a lot of people say they are the gold standard for turnkey investing. And so I read that book and I'm like, okay, the nice thing about it is that it has in the second half of the book, almost like a checklist for you as an investor, what you want to look for if you consider turnkey investing. I'm like, okay, with that checklist, I can interview turnkey providers and see if they're the good ones or not so good ones. And that's how I started, you know, like found the first property in Idaho for the amazing amount of, at the time, $16,000 down payment.
Wow.
and then went from there, you know.
And you've done that almost exclusively since the beginning, correct?
Yeah, exactly. So that was my first property. And then I started building the portfolio. And you got to know me a little bit when you were on my show, and we've been talking before and after and so forth. And I'm somebody who likes to talk to people and likes to talk about interesting topics. So whenever friends or colleagues or somebody ask me, hey, Axel, what you up to? I'm like, okay, I'm researching in this particular location for my next house, or I'm just trying to figure out if I can get on and on and on, babbling about like investments and real estate. And initially friends said, hey, can I do this too? And then some friends of friends said, hey, I heard you're helping Jeff. Can you also help me? Is that something that I could do? And at some point, my wife said, you know what? I don't really think it's fair that you're working for free all the time. I'm like, okay, there's maybe a point there. So I basically started ID Wealth Grower, set up a website and a shop and all that kind of stuff, and began a mentoring program that was in 2015. Okay. And we have been doing it ever since.
That's awesome. And so you're basically handholding somebody through this process then.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what I always say when people say, what's your ideal client? I always say, I'm looking for Henrys, right? So high earning, not rich yet. And so if they make the decision, they want to diversify whatever investments they do. Oftentimes they start with their 401k or some investments in stocks and stuff like that. And they realize, okay, well, maybe I should do, for diversification purposes, something with real estate. And regardless whether they own a place or have bought a place or not, from an investing perspective, a lot of people only hear the horror stories about the leaking toilets and all that bullshit, right? And so
sure.
I found, yes, they're sophisticated people. They know what they want. They oftentimes, in the last few years, don't want to work forever. They want to retire early if possible. And they want somebody where they can say, okay, I need this whole network of services, and I need access to properties that perform. And that's literally the sweet spot of where we're working.
Okay, perfect. Well, let's walk through that a little bit, because I don't think everybody really understands that. I've had Jim Shields on the phone. He's down in Florida, or on the podcast a long time ago. And Jim basically does, you know, turnkey real estate. They build to rent properties and build neighborhoods down in Florida. So, you know, for people that have watched the show and saw Jim on there, you know, they learned a little bit, but it's been a while. So why don't you share with us kind of how that whole process works, so people understand what the difference is between, well, just going and finding a house.
Right. Yeah. So fundamentally, there are a couple of things. I always say there are three pillars if you want to determine if you have, even just in the basic way, a good turnkey provider. And so the first pillar is the turnkey provider organization as a company has a department that you might call contracting or building or whatever kind of name you want to give it. And
sure,
it's a little bit, some turnkey providers specialize in only renovating properties. So they try to find what I always say, the ugly duckling in a good neighborhood, and want to bring it to be the shiny house on the corner, so to speak. Some,
yep,
specialize in what you just mentioned, BTR, where they basically find a piece of land in a good general location, do the whole thing, and they're basically, like, in a way, real estate developers in that particular pillar. And then there are some providers, like I work with one in Alabama, they do both, right? So but that's one pillar. So the one pillar within the organization is contracting, construction, building, renovating. The second pillar is basically, I always call it, like, very similar to a real estate agency, right? Because regardless whether they do renovations or they're building brand new properties, they need to be sold, right? So you have to have like a website, and you have to have the properties and the descriptions and the calculations and all that good stuff. So they do that. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing for my clients and what we do at Idea Wealth Grower, I have created relationships, like I just said, for example, with the guys in Alabama, and they have multiple of those relationships like my organization, and they send, whenever they have a property finished, the first dip, so to speak, to people like me, which gives me a little bit of an advantage, or my clients have a little bit of an advantage because they don't go on the MLS right away or any of that kind of stuff. And in the vast majority of cases, the good turnkey providers don't ever really need to invoke another agent or any kind of website or Zillow or any of that, because the network is absorbing the property. And what that means for the investor is that you don't have to pay any kind of real estate fees. Because basically, we're buying it directly, in a sense, from the builder. And yes, they obviously operate a real estate agency by name, in a sense, but their profit comes from the difference of what they either build it for or what they renovated it for and what they paid for it. And what you can basically say, and a lot of people poo-poo it, but I think it's just a matter of how do you weigh the value of certain services. I think it's fair that they ask market rate, right? And don't try to be at the same level like a flipper who tries to stay a little bit below market rate or stuff like that. So they charge market rate, and the measuring stick is, for my investors or for myself, they put something out. I say, okay, let's send an appraiser, right? So we trigger one of our financing agencies that we're working with. They send an appraiser. We find out, is this a fair price? If it appraises, okay, we buy it for that. If it doesn't appraise, then we see if they're willing to sell it for lower. So we never buy anything that is above appraisal, right? And if the property is appraised, that's one thing. Then we also have it inspected, obviously. So all those things that you would basically do when in the context of finding a property and buying the property. So that's the middle pillar.
I'm assuming this also during COVID kind of saved your investors from the silliness that was going on out there with, people over, as soon as it hit the MLS, I mean, people are paying hundreds of thousands of dollars more for a house.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, one of the things I think that distinguishes emotional people and investors, and there are many, but this is one, is to say, and I always preach this, real estate, for those that have been around a little while, have learned to look at location. And I preach every opportunity, and I thank you again that you give me an opportunity here. I always preach, pay attention to performance. Yes, location isn't irrelevant. I don't want to make that point. But if you are in a good location and the performance sucks, then why would you be invested in that? What you can do is you can say, okay, I look for a certain performance, which you define by certain criteria, and then you look at three properties next to each other and decide which one of those is in the best location. Fine. But if you tell me I first pick the property by the location and then I find out that I can't make any cash flow, that's silly, right? So for me, performance is really the driving force to select the property. The good thing is, I mentioned earlier that I'm working with a network of turnkey providers, and they obviously know what my criteria are, and that those are the same criteria for my clients. So a property that doesn't meet those criteria, they wouldn't even send to me. Right now, it's not super strict on up and down $50, but fundamentally, right? Like, it needs to be pretty close or meeting or exceeding the criteria. So that's basically the middle pillar for a good turnkey provider. And then the third pillar is the property management aspect. And the reason is, I mean, anybody who is invested in real estate, especially for like short term, medium term, long term rent, knows the importance of property management. But there is I call that a psychological component to it. And that is, if you think about it, like, let's take my example with the guys in Alabama. I know the CEO pretty well, and I talked to her and I had her on my show and stuff. And she confirmed that they have obviously a certain pride in their renovations or in their new build property. So when I or a client of mine approach their middle department for a property that they offered to us, my first thing is, I'm assuming that you are proud enough to your work bringing this property to market that there wouldn't be anything that you need me to pay for if something breaks for the first year. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if you're not proud about your first pillar organization, then you need to fix that, but don't make me pay for it. So you get basically the opportunity to get a one-year warranty. And I know you have experience in this space. When I first started, I looked into it and I looked at, like, Bigger Pockets was a really good resource for me when I first started. And I saw a lot of cases where somebody had bought a property, got property management, and something broke. And every single time, they were saying, in the end, I had to pay. And the reason was always, while the property management said, well, we went there, the thing is truly broke and needs to be fixed. The tenant has the rightful expectation that it works. And when they said, then find the guys who fixed it, who renovated it in the first place. And they said, well, I bought it from a flipper. I bought it from whoever. And it says in the contract, you bought it as seen. Well,
as it is.
We suicide for a turnkey provider to ever do this. That doesn't mean that their contracts don't say it. But there is basically an agreement that we do in addition to the contract for purchase, where we say that first year of warranty covers everything that you touch during your renovation. And I go as saying, okay, turnkey provider, renovation or building, but it's typically mainly for renovations where I say, okay, give me the list, the statement of work that you gave your contracting department to fix this place. And that is our list. If it says new bathroom, new kitchen, new switches, new floors, new whatever, that's the list. If any of those things breaks in the first year, you go fix it. And I always start from, I'm assuming you're very proud of the work that your organization
does. Yeah, well, as they should be.
On the B class, it's actually a little easier because you can get builder's warranties. Oftentimes, it's state mandated. You can get structural warranties and insurance and stuff. And we weave this into the purchase price. So it's covered for a whole bunch of years. But it's also a reality that they only give you these insurance policies because the likelihood of really any major repairs is pretty low.
That's one of the reasons why I like that buy a built to sell model. You've got a good 7 years before you're really going to start having any kind of breakage or anything like that. You know, in the long run, you might pay a little bit more for a property, but you know, the maintenance cost over time, as long as you just maintain it, just simple maintenance, you know, you'll stretch your major maintenance costs over a long period of time.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I always differentiate between maintenance and capital expenditures, you know, from a taxation perspective and from an expense perspective. And I have had I've actually had properties that were my residence and then I turned them into an investment property. And two times I had a brand new built house and the one had nothing in the first 6 years and the other one had nothing in the first 5 years that you would really consider something major or that wasn't covered by an insurance policy. So that also means, I mean, let's just be conservative and say you have nothing in the first 3 or 4 years. We are basically preaching put 5% away for maintenance. That's basically 5% more cash flow. And over a certain number of years, you can obviously invest that money in some way, shape or form. So it also is more ultimately than the 5% that it is nominally. But to go back to your question, so those are the three pillars of a good turnkey provider. Either construction or a renovation department, kind of like a real estate agency and property management, all under one roof. And if you're working with them for a while, there comes one more component into play that my clients actually benefit from. Because if I were the only one or any of my clients were the only ones stepping up and saying, okay, Alabama organization, I want to buy one of your properties, or maybe even two or three over the years, okay, then you own two or three. But if I buy two and three clients buy two and next year two more clients buy two and after 3 years we already have 15 or 20, you can imagine when I call Lindsay because one of my clients says, I don't know if these property managers know, you know, what I'm expecting in the area of communication. Not only do I not have to talk to the person who is the communicator of property management, I talk to the CEO. Because he or she is pretty happy that we have already 20, 30 houses on the books. And when I can call them, and I'm not saying this to brag, I'm just saying that's a reality. Well, if you can talk to them and say, I don't expect or assume that you really want to get rid of us. You know, that's probably not really your intention. And most of the time it gets fixed really fast. You know, so that's a little side benefit when you're basically limiting it. I'm also telling our clients, and I have lived this, is my reality, to try to build clusters. You know, don't have one house in every city of 12 different states, but, you know, like have a cluster of four or five in one area and maybe four, five, six in another area.
I mean, you can get scale with your property management and everything else when it comes to that.
Yeah, but see, the thing about it is, what I'm talking about is the starting point when you say, okay, I start a new cluster, and who is the turnkey provider that I'm working with? when you start with that turnkey provider, you have now over, let's say, 3 or 4 years have bought 3 or 4 properties, and something happens. I mean, things change, obviously. And let's say they had a really good manager in the property management department, but somehow something changed. They're not doing it so well anymore. Now you have an established portfolio. Now you have the experience with the area. Now you know what is kind of real and realistic. If you really feel that they're getting too squirrely, you can hire another property manager. But this thing that relates back to when you originally bought it, that's long gone. That's all history, right? And then you go purely by performance. I mean, one thing, I don't know if your audience is really that interested in, but what I also do for our clients is to say, I want you, from the mindset perspective, to see yourself as the queen or the king of your empire. And the first step we do when they join our mentoring program is to say, let's establish the LLC that is the foundation of your empire. And that LLC hires employees in a way. Now, they are not the traditional employees. One of them employees is called appraiser. One of them is called bank. One of them is called ECR provider. One of them is called real estate agency. One of them is called property management, right? So those are your employees, and they may have been brilliant when you hired them. And if they start slacking, what do you do if your employees start slacking?
Yeah, you fire them.
You fire them. And you, but see, if you, in the time that you're building this, develop the attitude, this is my kingdom or my queendom. I don't know if that's a word, but you know. Then, and you understand, they work for you and you pay them for their service. A lot of people, especially when we go to this, what I mentioned, Henry, people have a good job, they're making good money, they have disposable income, and they want to build an investment portfolio because they want to retire at 45 or 50. That's not what they learn, not at school, not at home. So it's a real process to get to the point to say, yeah, this is my thing. This is my portfolio. These are my houses. I have the certificates of title in my name. And these people work for me, right? That's what I mean. Like, I'm doing overdoing it sometimes a little bit with, you're the king of your empire. But from a mindset development, that's how you should approach it.
Yeah. Well, and you should, because too many people get into real estate. I mean, the horror stories you hear is the person that buys a house that they probably paid a little bit too much, or the renovation cost them a little bit more than they were planning on. Then they can't rent it for as high. So then, you know, the alternative is, well, okay, I just won't pay for a property manager. I'll just do the property management myself, especially when you're small. And, you know, that's where the horror stories happen, because you're not a professional. You basically created a job for yourself. And the more and more houses you have, the more you're running around town trying to deal with all this stuff. And, you know, you're cleaning the toilets and you're dealing with all the problems and everything else, versus build, you know, build in the property management cost, all the cost of that, where you're not the active you're not the active participant in the process. You know, that's the way I look at it.
Yeah, I'm with you on this, Jeff. The other thing about it is, if you look at any organization that is a little bit more than like 50, 60 people, right? Like a medium-sized company, the boss is not doing every job. It's just a fact, right? You have enough to do with being the leader and managing everything, and maybe, you know, negotiating contracts and developing strategy and stuff like that. That's what I mean by, you can call yourself the boss or the queen or the king, but that's your role. And you hire experts to do the other jobs that need to be done, right? And if you hire, and you can have a mishire, that happens, right? Like, I mean, and the other thing is also, I have seen, for example, one of my turnkey providers, they grew to, I think, a total of about 1,200 houses under management through a time of, I think, about 9 or 10 years. And what they didn't pay enough attention to is that when you have that much inventory to manage, you need to have property management. And within it, you have to not just have systems, but you need more and more people who really understand communication. Because your owners particularly want to be communicated about their assets. And if you say, okay, I only hire people who I can send out to, you know, like find out if a toilet needs to be fixed, or I only hire people who can deal with the landscapers, or I only hire somebody who's good at accounting and collecting the rent and making sure that it's properly entered into the appfolio system so it can be paid to the owners, all that is important. But I literally left one of those turnkey providers that when I first joined them was really good, met all the criteria, and more of my clients who also invested with me started complaining that the communication just sucks. And so I did literally what I told you. I called the founder CEO and told her about it. And two or three times she promised me that it would get better, but it didn't. Right. And so we had to fire her, you know.
That's the nature of business. I mean, you've got to deliver. If you don't, people will find someplace else, or there's lots of other alternatives out there.
And I mean, just to say from a business case, Jeff, sometimes I also have to say that I don't understand people, because they went from 1,200 properties down to 400 now, right? They basically lost a huge amount of their really well-built business just because of one thing like that, right? I mean, if you the amount...
Well, you lose... Yeah, they lose on two sides. They lose that property management revenue, but then they also lose people buying new properties and people like you referring people to them at that
point. Yeah, exactly. Well, and then you can imagine that they get ripped to shreds on bigger pockets, right? So when any kind of novice that doesn't necessarily come to you and me goes on bigger pockets and says, okay, is it a good company? And everybody tells them the horror stories, well, then they're not going to buy anything anymore. Even if they never owned anything before from them. So it's those two or two and a half kind of things for spending maybe $100,000 to get a really good communicator. I mean, how silly is that, right? Yeah. But it happens, you know?
Yeah, it does. And I think people, sometimes they grow too fast and they just don't know how to handle that growth. So, you know, if you were you starting out today in the current market with, you know, interest rates where they're at, real estate prices are certainly not inexpensive. What would your suggestion be, or what is the suggestion you have for clients when they're starting out today?
Well, the first thing that I had to learn, and this is now applicable to me, but it wasn't when I first started, is that you really need to look at your time horizon, right? Like when I started, I was 43 or something like that. So my realistic time horizon was probably like 20, 25 years or so. You know, I did never say I want to be an investor buying new properties when I'm 80. That was never the plan, right? But I was saying, okay, well, if it's really slow, it's going to take me 10, 15 years, 20 years maybe at the outside. Now, it actually only took me 12 years, but that's a different story. If I had to do it now at my current age, I would basically only make one difference, and that is I would look for properties still with a performance focus, but more into brand new properties versus renovated. And part of the reason is to ask yourself, why do you want to have the property? And the original idea of performance and generating passive income is obviously still there. But like I said before we started recording, there's also a little bit of a legacy thought that has come in where I'm saying, okay, well, I'm going to benefit from these properties from today, maybe another 25 years or so. But if I get a brand new property today that's 25 years old when I'm done, and it goes over to my daughter, for example, then she has a 25-year-old property that is still in the prime of performance. But if I look at the property, the one that I mentioned that I got for $16,000 that was built in 1978, right? If I make it another 25 years, this thing is going to be 85 years old.
Yeah.
Right? Or something, or maybe, probably about 85 years old, right? So,
yeah, it's going to need another major renovation at that point.
Yeah, it doesn't mean that it's going to fall apart, but it's definitely no longer in its prime. It's going to probably have all kinds of CapEx needs and stuff like that. So, the time horizon that you have ahead of yourself based on your age and how long you want to actually benefit from the properties is really an important driver on what would you actually get into. So I would get into a build to rent now. If I were when I was started, I would still start with the renovated properties because the cash flow is just better. So you're basically trading cash flow now versus cash flow later, because the build to rent properties start slower. But the reason that you get more cash flow now is because 25, 30, 40 years old. And when your build to rent property gets to 10, 15, 20 years old, it's going to get a really, really good, because purchasing power is basically off the money. It's a big differentiator. I always use like a little example. When I got to this place in Santa Barbara I mentioned earlier, I rented a place that was about 1,800 square feet for $2,200. For Santa Barbara, that was considered okay. The guy had bought that place and lived in it in 1967 for $68,000. And so I came to that place in 2002. So that was 30 years later. And yeah. I mean, not only was it paid for, but if he had a mortgage of $68,000 in 1967, he would have paid, what, $200 a month or something like that?
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, we made basically 10 times what he had to pay himself to pay off the mortgage. And I'm sure that place is still there. He probably still owns it and is probably in $4,500 or $5,000 now. Right. And so that aspect of the deteriorating of the value of money, that is really a big benefit, because I always tell my clients, think about it. The space of a house, if you keep it in good shape as far as maintenance, is not going to change. If you have a house that's 2,100 square foot now, it's going to be 2,100 square feet in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. The question is, how many of these green little pieces of paper do they need to give you to get the privilege to live in it? And because pieces of
paper, same size house 30 years later,
they get less and less valuable. So they have to give you more and more to have the privilege to live in the same space. And for you, the payment on your 30-year mortgage remains the same, right? So that's kind of like the part of the good deal. They need to give you more of the green pieces of paper, but you don't have to give more of them away to pay the mortgage. And a little nice cherry on the cake is that it also appreciates, right? But, you know, even if you don't really pay that much attention to the appreciation, purely looking at the cash flow, it's inevitable that you have to get more and more cash flow just because money loses value.
Yeah. Well, and not to mention you've got depreciation on the property you know, everything else too. Yeah. So. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. It.
Well, I use that mainly, that aspect of depreciation, appreciation, and then using leverage, right? Like, I mean, that's the other point to consider. Yeah. I always say to people when they say, am I not better off investing in the stock market? I said, okay, let's just say you invest something in the stock market and you pick a really good stock that increases 10% in value every year, never has a downturn. There's no, you know, it doesn't matter what the economy does. And you pay $100,000 for that stock. And now I come along and I pay $100,000 for my real estate and I get $500,000 of real estate. I can live with 3% appreciation and not even, it could basically be empty and I make 10%, right? So now it wouldn't want to be empty because somebody has to pay the mortgage. But the point is I get five times as much asset value and I get depreciation, appreciation, and cash flow. So, you know, I always say in real estate, if you really sit down with the numbers and you buy something that performs well, like we said when we started this conversation, it's not that hard to make 20% on your invested money. You know, and you show me any stock exchange where you have any kind of reasonable expectation that you make 20%, because you are such an awesome stock picker that you always pick the moonshots and never have one that goes down the toilet. And that's the benefit, right? We don't have to be good in picking. We just find a house for a fair price, appraised by an expert in a reasonable location, and that's it.
Yeah.
Right? And so
that's the beauty of it.
A big comparison. That doesn't mean that I don't have any stocks. And I even was lucky enough to buy a few that are real moonshots. But I also know that is not a dependable strategy, right? That's something that you do to diversify. But if and this is really where, going back to your question, what is your intention? If you look at the volatility of the stock market, you cannot really reasonably say that is your retirement plan, right? But what you can say is, I know that the purchasing value of money constantly goes down, the value of real estate goes up, and I can find people who pay off the loan. Well, if you take those three things together and you want to retire early, then it's just a matter of how many houses do you need? Literally, yeah. That's the only question you need to answer. And so
that's the math you have to do. And the beauty of it is, it's also, you know, instead of investing in bonds or something along those lines, that effectively, I mean, there's not much, even with higher interest rates, they're not that great. And this appreciates every single year. You know,
there's also there's one thing, because as you know, I'm originally from Germany and I still have family and connections to there and other European countries with friends and stuff like that. The United States is pretty much the only country that I'm aware of where you can get a 30-year mortgage at, let's say, right now, 7% interest. And then Mr. Powell suddenly starts listening to the president and brings it down to 5%. And you go and say, okay, there are plenty of banks and lending organizations. I want to replace my mortgage. And you get a new mortgage at a new rate. You pay off the old one, no penalty, no nothing. In almost every place in the world, if you want to get out of a mortgage early, you have to pay pretty steep penalties, kind of similar to like a 401k where you want to get to the money before you're 59 and a half. That's kind of how it is in almost every country, number one. And number two, the other thing is, yes, you can get a 30-year mortgage, but your interest rate is only fixed for 5, 7, or 10 years. So when that time period expires, and you, like we have many, many, you have them probably, I have them where we got mortgages 3.5%, 4%, and maybe 5%. And now they are like at 7 or 7.5 or whatever percent. Just imagine you had a mortgage and you bought a property at 4.5% and the 7 years are up and now it adjusts to 8%. Your whole plan, your whole cash flow idea, everything that you did is down the toilet.
It's gone. Yeah. Right? And you can't get out of it to...
To refinance a contract for a 30-year mortgage, which includes that every 7 years it resets. So I'm saying all of this because I have a little bit of that international experience to remind our audiences, you have it pretty good. The system that we have is actually pretty good. It gives a lot of benefits that we can use. And if we're willing to look a little bit over the edge of the border and say, how is it in other countries? By the way, including Canada, you cannot fix it more than 10 years in Canada either. You know, so having a 30-year mortgage after 12 months, for most cases, you can get a new one if Mr. Powell lowers the interest rates and stuff. There are these little hidden benefits that we all don't see. It's also not normal that everybody, whether it's for business or not, can depreciate an asset. Right, most countries don't let you do that unless you have a business, and on and on and on. So, you know, I think we need to be aware that we have a pretty good system when it comes to this. And I want to be one of the people together with you, Jeff, who educate others that you need to get in. And I mentioned this when we first talked. I think maybe a little more dramatically than other people that we right now, everybody who's on this planet right now living, is in a similar phase as far as where is the world going, like it was between like 1890 and 1915, 1920, where suddenly, you know, we had steam engines and electricity and industrial revolution and all that kind of stuff. I think we are in a time like that 100 years later where that is happening again. And the question becomes, how do you position yourself for that extreme dramatic change?
Sure. Yeah, we're on the precipice of something amazing, you know. And I think a lot of people are. It makes me laugh. I hear all the people, AI, it's just a flash in the pan. It's going to go away and everything else. Yeah, it's the same crowd that we're fighting against milling machines and machines in the woolen industry in England back in the 1820s and 30s, the Luddites. Okay, just assume that it's not going to fix, or that it's going to be there and you're going to be behind the eight ball. So totally agree. I think it's an amazing time to be alive. And I hope you and I take advantage of it as we go. So,
yeah, me too. I mean, I would even go a little bit more modern, right? Like I know a lot of people who initially said the internet will never be something that we all need. I know a lot of people who said, well, I have my phone hanging on the wall. It's always been hanging there. What is this stuff with having to carry it around? I don't need that. And so forth. So there have been these kind of things. What I believe is different in this particular case is that these things that we have maybe seen or our parents have experienced, they were some new technology that changed our behaviors. But when I look at what's coming now, I would say, and there are experts that wrote books about it that I'm pretty tied into, that say, for example, imagine you have humanoid robotics everywhere, then the average cost of an hour of labor will probably go down to about $1. $1 for an hour of labor, even for more sophisticated computer type jobs. The other thing is when you look at it, every morning this kind of glowing ball is coming up on the horizon and it provides so much energy that the whole globe, every just on one day's basis, could have energy for like a decade or more.
Yeah.
So as we're harvesting more and more of what that ball on the in the sky is providing to us, it basically leads to a point where this energy is also going to be basically free. Especially when you think about the guys that cost you $1 an hour in labor, they're going to build the things, they're going to go install the things, they're going to go maintain those things, right? So, and we all know if you do this on your own house right now, they give you a 25-year warranty on all this panels. You can see that nowadays, in which I find totally like it, in a way it's freakish, but it's also cool. You can buy an electric car that has between 7 and 10 times as much battery storage in the car than what you could buy on the open market to take the electricity that comes out of your solar panels and store it in a battery that supplies your house. Which basically means if for some strange, weird reason, the sun doesn't shine, there's no wind, and the power grid is off, you plug in your car into your house and you're good for a week.
Yeah.
So when you think about it that way, and this is all not utopia, this is not stuff that we need to develop in the next 20 years, you can literally go and buy this today, no problem.
It's there today, yeah. I mean, I've got 2 Tesla batteries on the side of my house.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and I mean, our solar system, I mean, the beauty of it is, you know, our system was designed to not, I don't sell to the grid.
Okay.
So my excess energy is put into those 2 batteries because then at night, you know, by the time it gets dark, we've got those 2 batteries and we live off those batteries all night long.
Yeah, exactly.
So now, my energy falls. Yeah.
Yeah. But imagine, Jeff, you were to also get yourself like a Model 3 or a Model Y Tesla with a 60, 70, 80 kilowatt battery on it. If for whatever reason your system cannot charge because we have like really shitty weather or what, you plug in your car into your system and you're good to go. What I'm getting at is when we and anybody listening to us, just step back whenever you have time and say, okay, these guys on the podcast said an hour of labor is $1 and energy is free. And now start thinking, what would that mean for life as we know it? And it's so profound. Mm-hmm. It's not just a cell phone or an internet is available or you can get from dial up to broadband or whatever. It really literally changes everything.
Yeah.
Right. And so.
Well, and I think it's there. Yeah, I think it's there already. I mean, as an example, in one of my businesses, we do what are called rank and rent websites. And what used to cost me a fortune in content production and everything else, AI handles now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I basically created, I created a program within ChatGPT that I basically can have my assistant who's in the Philippines plug into, you know, into her version of ChatGPT, and it can create the same thing it would take me time to write in a matter of a day. She can create a month's worth of content that we put up on our sites, you know, and that might cost me $40, $50. It used to cost, you know, if I did it, it was time. And if somebody I hired to create that content, you know, blog articles and stuff like that, you know, it was $500, $600, $700, $800 to get somebody to do that. So, I mean, that's just one simple example, getting to your, you know, dollar per hour robot, you know, we're moving in that direction. And, you know, I, I love the world. I mean, I love the fact that we can do this now. And yes, some people are going to get hurt by it, but you know, all right, figure out a way to get in front of that instead of be waiting behind it and watch it go past you. Figure out how to get in front of it. So when somebody asks me today, well, how can I make money? How can I make enough money that I can start buying real estate? Well, figure out something you can do in the AI world where you're an expert and get paid to do that. And then that will generate the revenue you need to be able to do the other stuff that you want to do.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. And I would actually strengthen that point a slight little bit, Jeff, because I think this is a window of opportunity between where we are right now, where people that have skills or have acquired those skills are valued highly. But because AI is so rapidly getting better and better at everything, that window of opportunity, if you ask me, I would guess is maybe 5 years. So for whoever says, okay, how can I make money? I totally agree with your point. Get into the AI database computer industry, but also be aware you need to make as much money as possible. And I say this mainly to say, if you get that job and you start getting paid really, really well, and they pay extremely well, the one other thing I strongly recommend, if you want to really secure your future, is be as frugal as you can be for those 5 years.
Yeah.
Because if you do that, if you can have 50, 60% of the money that comes in available to reinvest, you're going to get a portfolio so quickly that in 5 or 6 years, maybe 10 at the most, you never have to work again.
Yeah. Well, you reach your freedom day. Yeah. You know, and at that point, you, okay, I don't have to worry about money anymore. I don't have to think about where's my next paycheck coming from, or where's, you know, if I own a business, where's the next sale coming from? Because I have the money. I don't need the money.
Yeah,
it's coming in.
Yeah, I see that too. But I also see one other aspect, right? People say, okay, what do we do when labor is a dollar an hour? And I say, no, you have to ask the question differently. The real question is, what will the government allow you to do so that you earn your UBI? So if you don't do what they want you to do, and that might change with whoever is in power at the time, you may not get UBI. And then the question really becomes, okay, well, what do I live off? Well, if you don't need UBI because you provide something that everybody needs, like shelter, meaning like housing, and even the government, I mean, you know, they have the choice to either build the housing themselves or they pay us because we own the housing. That will still be there. So if you come on the side where you and I already live and say, okay, I'm getting assets that have value no matter what happens, and I don't want to be one of those people who get told you can only do A when you do B properly, the way we want it, your government wants it. That is a level of freedom, since we're talking about freedom day or time freedom point and so forth. There is a component of freedom that is not only financial, it's also what are you still able to do with whatever you're defining as freedom or not, because you have no other source of income than whatever the government is going to give you.
Yeah, absolutely. That's fantastic. Great way to end the show there. Let's transition to the fast five questions.
Yes.
All right. First question, you wake up in the morning, businesses are gone, you have $500 in your pocket, a laptop computer, a place to live, food and clothing. What are you going to do first?
Well, if I know what I know today, I would probably start investing.
Okay. How would you, so you're starting off with absolute zero, but $500. How would you get back into investing at that point?
Well, like I said, if I know what I know today, there are some AI companies that are rapidly growing.
Okay.
And that's what I would invest in. I mean, there are several that grow 100% a year. Right now, $500 is not going to be easy to survive on. But, you know, if you double it every year, that doesn't take too long before you have something that you can actually use for other stuff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So next question. What's the biggest business mistake you've ever made?
Starting to invest too late.
Yeah, I'm thinking of writing a book. My advice to my 20-year-old self, my financial advice to my 20-year-old self, and what I would have done, and all the mistakes that I made along the way. So
yeah, if I can, for your audience, and it's not quite exactly that, but it goes very much in that direction. A book that I really like is called The Wealthy Gardener by John Soforic. And he wrote that for his son, basically with that intention. It's not what I would have done, but what he is basically saying, instilling the necessary ideas about money and business into your 20-year-old self, so to speak.
Okay, awesome. What's a good book that you'd recommend? That you gave us one, you got to give us another one now.
Right now, in this day and age, I would say the book is titled Stella, Stellar, by Tony Seba.
Okay, excellent. What's a good tool that you use in your business every day that you might recommend?
For any purpose or just in general?
Just whatever tool you use on a regular basis.
I would say the Google Calendar.
Okay.
I have literally, yep. I mean, my... I'm saying this because people always ask me, how can you get so much shit done? And I'm basically saying, between myself, my wife, and my assistant, we all run the exact same Google Calendar. And we put stuff in, having dinner, having breakfast, going shopping, having podcast interviews, and so forth. And yeah, if you can use it properly, put the reminders and all the other good stuff in, I think I'm running a pretty efficient shop.
Nice. Yeah, same way. Yeah, I feel the same way. I mean, I get the same question. How can you get all that? It's impossible. How can you do all this? No, it's not impossible. It's just, I have a very specific, and I don't have a lot of junk in my life that takes me away from the important things. Yeah. You know, the income producing activities, IPAs, that, you know, I just work on income producing activities all day long, you know, and I segment my day out to, okay, focus on income producing activities, focus on, you know, learning and everything else. I build out my day that way. So yeah, same thing. Totally agree. Last question. What is your definition of freedom?
For me, it's basically the ability to do with my time what I'm passionate about.
Okay. I like it. That's just simple and straightforward. Live your passion and you'll never work a day.
Right.
Well, excellent. If somebody is interested in your coaching and learning how to get into build to rent and all that, what's the best place to get a hold of you at?
To get a hold of me, I mean, you can put my name, obviously, in any kind of search engine and you find it. But if you want to book a call with me, just go to idealwealthgrower.com. And on the homepage at the top right-hand corner, there's a little button that says discovery call. And you can book that and you have basically an hour of my time.
Perfect. Love it. Well, we'll put that into the show notes page. So thank you for being on the show. It was fun to still, you know, continue our conversation from before and in between and everything else. Thank you for being on the show, my friend.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeff, for having me.
All right, folks, reach out to him. He does know his stuff. And I think, you know, where the direction he's going in, I believe too, is the best world kind of going forward. I think that the whole turnkey idea, I think, makes much more sense in the real estate world today, and a lot less unclogging of toilets. So thanks for joining us. Make sure you subscribe to the channel and we will see you guys back here the very next time.
Thank you for listening to the Freedom Nation podcast. You can find us on Apple Podcasts and all the major channels. Wherever you're listening, please subscribe to the channel and leave a rating and review. If you have friends and family that could benefit from their own Freedom Day, please share with them. Finally, join Freedom Nation by following us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.